So you got 40 minutes for conversation, well, not conversation, 40 minutes for lecture, and then a 10-minute chat. And I'm being obnoxious about timing today because there's just so much that I need to get done. Okay. I'm glad.
But yes. Sorry, David, let me get out of your way.
Okay, so we're into the why question. And I'm going to approach this talk differently from the way that it's usually done because they really cut down the content usually, and you get caught up into one idea, which is the panarchy loop. And the panarchy loop shows up in practically every SFI thing I've seen, but you've heard the term that Edward Tufte says, chart junk. It's like, it doesn't mean anything. It never means anything. So the panarchy model is actually the one concept that I usually tell people it'll take you 10 years to figure out how to really use it. Because you think you know it, and then people start asking about it, oh, we don't know it after all. So I've been approaching it in the other direction, which is to come in and look at it from a direction of the panarchy assumes that things flow right. What happens if things don't flow the right way? So this talk is going to have four parts to it. Not all equal time. And actually, I could stop on one slide. It would be pretty boring, but I could talk about ecological understanding in four different contexts. Usually talk about this in one, and people get it mixed up. So the first one, errors, attentions, and traps, which is ecological understanding. And this is what we've been doing within the system changes research circle. So this is stuff that's really new. Bateson is not new. He's really old. Gibson and Ingold are relatively new. You'll see there's more citations to Ingold these days. But the focus here is, and the reason we started system changes in the first place was because people were focused on the system and trying to understand the system all the time. But my premise on all this is that people are only interested in systems to the extent that they change or they don't change. So you either want a system to change, and it won't change, or it changes too fast, and you go, wait, stop. And so people get confused, and so you're just trying to get that. So that's the orientation. The first one that's really a real agenda, that has a lot of work behind it, is socio-ecological systems perspective. And so people, you'll hear say socio-ecological, they go, okay, do you mean number B, which is socio-ecological, or do you mean number A or B, which is social ecological? So it's no wonder people get confused, right? So social ecological systems perspective comes from the Tavistock Institute. It's post-war, and Emory and Trist are people in that community, and I'll talk about that. In that, and here's where the question has been that we've been trying to drill into you. What is the primary system of interest? What is the primary system of interest that you're doing in your research? Now, you can change, but you can't say that, you know, I'm focused on here, and then it's like, oh, you know, my primary interest is in Ontario, and you're doing all your work in Toronto. It's kind of like, well, should you shift your system of interest to Toronto then? Because you're doing all this work in Ontario, you're saying, but you're not recovering it. So in the case of socio-ecological perspective, the organization is the primary system of interest. Okay, you are trying to change the organization. There's an ecology around the organization that is changing at the same time. B, socio-ecological systems and panarchy. This comes out of the Stockholm Resilience Center today. It goes back into Holling's work and Walker's in Australia. Peterson was at Waterloo. Now he's at Stockholm. And in this case, you want the ecology as the primary system of interest. You're trying to change everything. Not just one thing inside the system, you're trying to change everything. And last one, the ecosystem approach, which has elements of the socio-ecological approach in it, is done by the Resilience Alliance. David Walter Taves he's emeritus from University of Guelph. James Kay, who you get into, was at Waterloo, and Martin Bunch, who is a student of both of them, is at York University, and he's associate dean running the program there. So in that case, sustainable development projects are the primary system of interest. So when people say, oh, I'm working on the ecology, it's kind of like, okay, which ecology are you talking about? Which system are you talking about? So one of the questions I have when we talk about systems is, which stuff you've been working on, and should you actually do an intervention? Should you do anything? Now, this is one of the challenges I have with designers. So are you predisposed to change something in the system already? But the general belief in systems theory and systems thinking is you don't change a system you don't understand. Because there are, when you think about things, oh, synergy. Synergy means that there's good things coming out of two things coming together. There is the idea of negative synergy. You can make things worse. So are you going to take the Hippocratic Oath, which says, you know, I'm not going to kill this patient. I don't know what's going on in this patient. You know, I'm working on this patient, and I can actually hurt them, and so I'm just not going to do anything. Or are you actually going to do the what is called bias for action? And bias for action is popular in the management literature from Tom Peters in the 1980s. I'm cutting over slides. Yes?
Sorry, could you use the mic, please? It's a lot clearer. Maybe I'm just deaf, but it's just louder.
Okay.
Thank you.
You want the voice of God.
Dumbing.
Yeah, okay. So I have a blog post on this, on doing, not doing. So you can look at that if you're interested. But this orientation that comes from Acuff, and the question is, what is your orientation on system change over time? And so you describe reactive, which is the past was better. You've got inactive, which is doing nothing. You've got preactive, which is the future is always better. And you've got interactive, which is dealing with the present. So those of you familiar with the Long Now Foundation and those sorts of ideas where we're dealing with the present, there's philosophical discussions about the future exists or doesn't exist. But when you're doing design work, the question is, what are you doing now as opposed to what you're doing in the future? So willful action and non-obtrusive action are common in Chinese philosophy. They have the idea of wei and wu wei. And so wu wei is often described as doing nothing, but actually it's not that. It's the natural course of action, natural things that happen. And so to decenter this a little bit, I like talking about beavers. Let's talk about the beaver. I'm going to go through a beaver example. And the reason I'm going to talk about beavers is we get caught up quite often when we're talking about human beings that it's kind of like, well, are humans part of nature or are humans not part of nature? And humans have human will, so okay. I like the beaver because the beaver actually changes its environment, but it's not human. So we can talk about that a lot. And so, of course, beavers, they build dams and they have lodges where they stay. And these are natural formations. They've gone over many thousands of years. There's a video which I was trying to figure out beavers and look at this. So there's actually some interesting BBC videos on creating beavers and beaver dams. So they create the dam, so it creates a pool of water, and the water fills up. Then they create their lodge, and the lodge. So they do the dam first, they do the lodge second. And one of the things I discovered is that beavers really hate the sound of running water, and so when there's a break in the dam, they go and they fix it. So the way we're approaching system changes is we're looking at three processes. Now, I didn't get to talk to you in the last class. It's in the ends of the slides on object process models. And the question essentially is, do you look at objects first, or do you look at processes first? And this approach takes processes first. So what I'm going to say is there are three that we're looking at. One is correcting actions. The second is reordering attention. And the third is escaping traps. Now we're talking about beaver, not about beaver traps. We're talking about ecological traps. And so here's an example of an object process model. So the correcting errors would be rebuilding the habitat. So they could have a breached beaver dam, in which case they actually fix it, make it secure again. They can have a lodge that's breached, and they go back and secure that. And so beavers spend a lot of time fixing their environment. Reorienting attention, the beaver would, of course, stop at any time if they hear predators coming. And they would actually act on that. And so when they hear a noise, something unfamiliar, they would deal with that. The third one, of escaping traps, the article that I was reading has been about the beavers moving north into Alaska. And they are starting to change Alaska because as climate change has happened, they're moving, and moving very slowly. So you have different rates of things happening where beavers are moving faster than the environment can change around them. Object process models always have the object process language, so I can check to make sure I know what I'm talking about. But the idea behind the understanding of the environment comes and get, watch the slides later, listen to me now, it'll be a little clearer. So the question is, when you are drawing the system, is the system bounded by what you think, so the beaver, or is the system the beaver and the environment together? So this is one of the things that are misleading when you're doing system thinking. People think, oh, the beaver is the system. It's no, the beaver in the habitat is the system, right? So if you're doing that, then does it make sense for you to be drawing circles around the beaver and saying, oh, that's the whole thing? So this shows up in the work of Tim Ingold, where he's drawing some of this stuff and makes differentiation between the way that most people draw. And so you've got this idea of the brain. And so people who think that everything you know about the world is inside your head, they would say, no, it's interaction between your brain and the world. And so this idea of ecology of mind. So the ecology is outside of your body. So how could you actually know what's happening outside your body? And is that part of the system? I'm going to skip over.
That's the galaxy and Saturn thing we were talking about earlier.
Skip over here. For time.
Can you see my timing clock?
Yeah, I'm watching time. Okay, so, go to the second one. So, the socio-ecological systems perspective, there are actually three perspectives that happened at the same time. And I'll give you the story about how they actually came about. So, firstly, you have the socio-psychological perspective, which in effect was soldiers coming back from the Second World War. So the Tavistock Institute for Human Relations was related to the military. And so they had all these soldiers come back from war with what you would today call PTSD, right? And so the question is, well, how do they adjust? And fundamentally the question that's asked when you do the socio-psychological perspective is, do you change the patient, do you change the returning soldier, or do you change the society to suit the soldier? And they both have to change. But that is what socio-psychological is. The socio-technical systems perspective came out of the coal mining age. They used to mine coal by hand. They'd send in a team of 7-8 people. They'd be like a family. They'd rotate on and off. They'd be autonomous groups. And then you brought in machines. And what machines do would tear down a wall of coal, and then they dig it out. But what happens when you get big machines, people get injured, and so they're getting a lot of people who were getting, the teams weren't working out, there's injury, there's stress, all these sorts of things. So the socio-technical perspective, which we'll cover more next week, was about that. How do you optimize so that the machines and the people can work together? You change the machines and you change the human beings. The socio-psychological perspective is outside of organization, because organizations tend to get frozen in the way they work on things, and they have the ecology around them, and so how do you deal with that? So we'll have a system, and we'll have a system inside the environment, and there are four things that you look at. Firstly, let me look at this so we can get up. So L11 at the top, you have systems, so you have part-part relations. So you have inside the system, you have changes that are happening. So, say that a company is about to get acquired. It just comes out of the newspaper. A company is going to get acquired. So inside the company, people are just worried, like, what's going to happen to my job, all these sort of things, and it affects the performance of the company. You have the L12, the planning process, which is what the organization does to the environment, right? So it says, okay, I'm going to put out a press release. We're going to do this and do that, and, you know, we don't want to be taken over. You have the environment, which is L21. You have the learning from the environment. So after you've done the activity, so we put out the news and people say, we don't want to be acquired. Then another company comes up and starts, they want to acquire from us. And it's like, oh, okay, well, now we have to deal with that. And you have learning going on in the circle between L11 and L21, L12 and L21. And then you have the environment, and those are things that are happening in the environment that are outside all of this. And so a good example of right now is actually what's happening in Wuhan with the coronavirus, which is, okay, you can't influence that, that's the environment acting on the environment. So this original research from Emory and Trist prescribed four ways of approaching it. And the way they looked at it was, in effect, whether there's competition or not competition. So imagine a world, it's a flat world, and you have a critter and you have food. And so if it's a random placid environment, then what happens, there's food everywhere. So the strategy is just move, okay? There's no problem, there's no conflicts. The second case is clustered placid. In this case, you've got two critters, you've got more than one critter on a planet, on a surface. There's lots of food, but what happens occasionally is you run into the other person. And when you run into the other person, the rule is go elsewhere. The third one, disturb reactive, is you no longer have a flat surface, you've got bumpy hills. There's still food around, but what happens is that you have to actually now plan ahead, because if there's food and there's someone else there, it's like, okay, you have to dodge the territory, plus you have to dodge the other people you're competing with. And then the fourth one is a turbulent environment where you've got an earthquake. So this is where we're talking about the environment, and in this environment, the question is, can you control it? And when you're looking at the system, does that include it? So if you were in an industry, and this is again organizational work that would tend to be used in, although it could be used in government, military sort of applications, if you were in a placid environment, then you need really just a placid organization. Things that, you know, they do the proto-learning stuff, they just do things regularly. But if you are in an environment where it's turbulent, where the term for turbulent came was that Trist was looking for a way of describing it, and he was on a really bumpy airplane, and he goes, oh, and they say, oh, you're in a turbulent, we're going through air turbulence. And so apparently he was smiling as he was throwing up in his bag. So the idea of turbulence is you can't predict. When you're in a turbulent environment and there's other people there, the prescription is you have to actually now coordinate with the other people there, because you're not worried so much about the earthquake as you are into running into each other. Okay, so that's the brief on the socio-ecological perspective. And I'm going to go into the social-ecological This was anarchy. Now, so within the ecological world, actually in systems, and this is where you run into a problem, is a question about resilience. There's two types of resilience, and there's two different definitions. Engineers want resilience that means that it will return to the original state. So you break something, you want to get resilience back, you want to go to the original state again, right? That's not what ecologists mean. Ecologists mean the ability to stay with the same structure and function through multiple stable states. And so we're not set up today to watch the video. The idea of multiple stable states, there's a video that I've been using from MIT, and what it is balls and blankets. And so the way you think about this is you have the ball, you put it in the blanket, and you move the blanket around, right? And the ball always goes to the bottom. Now, there are multiple troughs within the blanket. And so if you're tossing the blanket up and down, it could be that ball goes up and comes down the same place, or if it's in the shallow zone, it'll roll over to someplace else. So this is fundamentally the idea they have about multiple stable states. Multiple stable states means that you have multiple places where the balances, the force of powers all work. So if you're thinking about in biology, or we think about losing weight, I'll use my example, losing weight, there are set points. And so, when you go down, so I've lost 10 pounds over the past couple of years, but I can't get beyond that. I mean, I have to go down 10 pounds and I stop, right? And so I eat a little more, I eat a little less, it seems like I stay around this weight. That is what they would call an attractor. That's at the trough, at a ball in the bottom of that blanket. So you see these diagrams, and then quite often
where you see this idea about the equilibrium state change, where it's possible that you have a perturbation, you have a system that actually is shaking a little bit, and if the system is resilient, it'll return to that same attraction point. However, if there is a big shift, that's what they call a regime shift. And the idea of regime shift is used not just in the political sense, but it's used in the ecological sense, because they're talking about not just the system, but also the environment around it that's changing at the same time. So the question would be, how far can you displace a ball in this cup? And where will it go before it flips over into an alternative stable state? And is that really a stable state or one that's just temporary? Now I'm going to talk about panarchy, and I'm going to talk about it backwards, because I'm going to draw your attention to the two states that people don't talk about with panarchy, which are the traps.
But before you move on, I want to point out something. I think what you just presented is really important, and the thing you've seen before that is the oversimplified version that comes up again and again in SFI is the Venn diagram.
Yeah.
And the point of what you were just doing is that things that are in stable states that meet certain criteria are not necessarily close to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like what you just said, but I wanted to stop and point out for
thanks. Yeah, before we got the balls and blankets video, which I'd love to show you, and you guys can follow through on the link, it was hard to get that idea, because people think, okay, we have this idea of this loop, and just go back and just go around this loop, right? And I'll explain the loop in a minute. But essentially, the idea that everyone has been doing in the prior SFI classes is, oh, there's this loop, and it's birth and death sort of thing. It's kind of like, if there's a birth and death, then why do anything? Why intervene in a system if it's just going to burn, you know, if you know, you don't need to intervene. That's not where the problem is. The problem is if you are not on the loop. So there are two states that you have to look out for. One is called a poverty trap, and the other one is called a rigidity trap. The poverty trap is one that's known more often, which is you have a neighborhood, or you have a society that is caught, so it's poor, it doesn't have resources, and it can't dig itself out. And what happens is that the poverty trap is actually one that is resilient. So one of the faults I find when people talk about resilience is they always wonder, well, we've got a resilient system. I say, no, you want to look for systems that are not resilient. If you have a system that's resilient, you can't change it. So those of you, you know, those people in criminal justice who have tried to tackle the mafia is really resilient. And it's like, okay, you know, if you want the mafia, it's like, okay, let's go study the mafia. We'll study resilience. That's the way you're going to study resilience. But if you're going to look for the opportunity for change, the changes are most readily happen in the poverty trap, where you don't have enough energy. So if you gave the system more resources, you gave them a little boost. The question is, could you get them out of that trough, get them out of that low point, and kick them back on to the track that goes around? The other side is the rigidity trap, where it is so rich and so connected that it's a complex system and you can't take it apart. And so these are the systems that we have running globalization, as an example. And you kind of say, well, I'd like to not be global. And it's kind of like, well, it's pretty tough to not be global, you know, not participate in that, because it's everywhere. And so getting off and getting that correction would require you to change the resources. So the idea that you have, if you're going to use this model, is look for points where there is low resilience and the possibility of change. Yes?
Is an example of that the too big to fail?
Pardon?
Too big to fail,
yes. And so what happened was that in that case, the belief was, well, what they did was that they provided more resources. So if you go through the full loop, then that the full loop includes a collapse. And so the question is, are you better off with a system you have that is dysfunctional in some respects, or do you want to actually collapse the system and reorganize? That depends on your point of view.
Rob, question?
Yeah.
Resilience, so poverty traps are a form of resilience. But then the rigidity traps as well.
Yes.
So then, is this low resilience or high resilience?
Yeah. This is where finding the illustrations to make it clear are really tough. You'll see it in a moment in the other, because it's a three-dimensional thing that you rotate around.
And just one more, so like this panarchy, or sometimes it's called an adaptive capacity, is it a characteristic of some systems, or is it a characteristic of just ecological systems, and we see it in other, in the real world as well? Or is it something that we're going to have to look into and uncover?
It comes from ecological systems. Uh-huh. So if you were thinking about just changing part of the system, not changing part of the ecology, I'd say, well, why are you using this? Because, yeah. So definitely in this world, we're talking about interactions between wholes. Because you're talking about forests and lakes and, you know, how these things interact together, you can't control any of them. When you get into businesses, if you're talking about, you know, independent companies in different industries, you could talk about that about an ecology, because you can't control them all. But then it's like, well, if they're another industry, do I really care about them or not? So, yeah. So the adaptive cycle, we said. So we'll work on two dimensions first. So the dimensions we have are potential and connectedness. So the connectedness dimension is two systems and whether they are coupled or tightly coupled or loosely coupled. And the potential is energy. So we start off with alpha, the birth phase. It comes down through a exploitation. So you start off in alpha. You come down through an exploitation phase. So this is kind of like a startup company. It goes up to a conservation phase. So you're coming from low connectedness and low potential. So you're starting with a seed, as an example. And from that, it grows, and then it gets to the point where you have capital. So you now have high connectedness and high potential. You have a tree, as an example. So you've gone from the seed to becoming a tree. You have the going down into the release, the omega. So that is the death, which is the tree dying and decaying. And then you have the reorganization, which is the potential for the resources to get recombined in another way. Okay. So this is working in two dimensions. Now you put in the third dimension, and this is where it gets confusing, is that the resilience is the third dimension. And so the question is, do you want a resilient system or you don't want a resilient system? But you've got this band that is three-dimensional. It's not two-dimensional, so you have to be really careful with it. There are times you want resilience and the times you don't want resilience. If you're interested in change, resilience is a bad thing. Now with that, you've also got the system inside of systems. So we have the tree inside the forest. And inside the tree there could be animals, squirrels, whatever. You've got multiple systems at play here. So panarchy, the actual full panarchy model, is all scales. It is the tree, it is the forest, it is the squirrel in the tree, at all scales. And the sort of way that to think about this is that when you look at the loop on the right, you have the adaptive loop, which is one of the loops, okay? But there is always a slower and larger system, and there is always a smaller and faster system. So one of the examples I talk about is after a forest fire, what happens first is that very small shrubs and small bushes actually grow first. You can't regrow the old trees back. You have to start off with all the ground cover and get that working. And then over time, you get bigger trees and bigger trees, and eventually you would recover to the area where you recover to the longer time period. But when you're looking at the forest and looking at the trees, you have the soil, which is really slow, and it has things that remember what was happening there. And you've also got things that grow very quickly, so whatever shrubs that come up in that period. So when you're looking at systems, and this is one of the hard parts of dealing with systems, is that you have to figure out what level you're at and where these all stack with each other. Back to class, we have time. The last one, the ecosystem approach. The socio-ecological systems approach, socio-ecological systems perspective, was both descriptive and prescriptive in the way they did it. The social-ecological systems approach is primarily descriptive. It doesn't prescribe what you're going to do with it. But there are the researchers in the Resilience Alliance wanted to apply their knowledge. And so they have what's called the ecosystem approach. This book came out, and I'll tell you the story behind the book. Timothy Allen, who's one of the editors for Columbia, said that, and this is a good book, on methods, came out in 2008, said it's pretty hard to release a book when two of your authors die during the publishing of it. And so there is this page that's actually no longer there. I just noticed, I went back, this is actually on archive.org. James Kay was a professor at University of Waterloo doing work around living systems and thermodynamic energy, these sorts of things. And so he's kind of the guy that's at the key of all this. And the word was that when he was in the scientific community, and Tim Allen says that they were talking to people on the Nobel Committee, and the guy said, "Your work has not gone unnoticed." So if he had lived, we might have had a Nobel Prize winner at Waterloo. So his work, to start off, this is the work from 1999 about how you try to combine the social and the ecological together in trying to put these two ideas together. And so one of the things you'll note, and kind of got these highlighted, soft system methodology is what he chose. And so in the examples that follow, the question you run into when you're dealing with the ecological, the panarchy people, is the panarchy people fundamentally came at this from a biological and an ecological perspective, where they're interested in living systems, but they're not particularly interested in people. So I went to the Resilience 2011 meeting, and they came out with the Resilience Handbook. And so you can go and search on the Resilience Handbook, and I took a look at it and go, "Well, this is really interesting and a little strange." So I went to the talk, and that's when I discovered the preconceptions that come in, because they're talking about, okay, well, how do you do a survey, and say, well, you know, you do a survey and you count the people, and they say, well, why would you do it that way? And it's like, well, you take inventory. So you take an inventory of people. And that's because they take inventories of trees and they count trees. And so the premise behind that was that people are all the same, and that's the way you deal with them. So the ecologists in the panarchy community now have what they call social ecological systems, but they actually don't focus on the social, they focus on the ecology first and add the social. Now, the group that in the Resilience Alliance are the ones actually are focused on actually trying to take those ideas and work on them. And they use soft system methodology because the soft system methodology allows you to appreciate the people. And so in soft system methodology, in a pure scientific sense, you're more interested in the objective things. And this is what's real in the world. We can go measure the water, we can count the trees, we can do that sort of things. But in soft system methodology, you end up with the ideas of constructivism. You know, if everyone believes this, and that's what the truth is, it doesn't matter what the science says, that's what people believe. And so you need to combine those methods to get these things working. It's interesting reading through the original articles, and this article that I've cited is actually the evolution of the ecosystem approach. You can download it. And so it goes through the history of it and how it came about and where they are. This is the adaptation that was done by that was done with Martin Bunch. This is when David Walter Taves was done, and they had this idea about calling it Amish, and in that one they modified it. So each one of these ones, it's more interesting that these are case studies where there are socio-ecological systems that have done interventions. I like these drawings. These are interesting. So you have the ecological system, the sociological system, and in the left. On the right, now they recognize that there's multiple levels within the ecological system and the socio-ecological system. So again, now you're getting down to, well, which systems can you change, which ones can't you change, which ones will you influence, or which won't you. This is Martin Bunch's paper. Martin's at York University, I said. So he's done work in Kathmandu. These are the models he developed in Kathmandu. He did work in Chennai, the slum. The story about the Kathmandu one is the one that was actually a little more interesting. He tells a story about having problems with the slaughterhouses, because people are living too close to the slaughterhouses. And so the slaughterhouses also had dogs around them. And so the dogs were actually picking up the infection, and then through their feces it would go into the water, and you end up with a cycle. And so, you know, could you remove the dogs? Well, you can't remove the dogs because the dogs are guards for the people living there, and so people would not get rid of their dogs. So how is it you can actually solve this loop, which started off as a health problem, but it's actually a public policy problem, because now it's like, do you ban dogs? Where do you put the slaughterhouse? You know, how do you share the river? These sort of things that came up. And this is more from Martin's work. So those are the four perspectives and four ways of ecology. How many do you have time, Lorraine?
You have 3 minutes and 58 seconds.
Oh, okay. So I can go backwards and cover more stuff. What if people are, now everyone's in their deer lights. Because a lot of content.
We have 10 minutes for questions or discussion. So up to y'all.
Yeah.
I have a question about in interdisciplinary work, they have a concept about trading zones between disciplines and the kind of frontier spaces. And you could think of disciplines as being systems. Mm-hmm. Their own. Is there any kind of comparative study of frontiers between systems, different systems, and the kind of transition spaces?
Yeah. That's definitely in the socio-ecological system when they're doing the panarchy stuff. So in that case, you're actually looking at the whole, right? Because if you're looking at transition space between two parties or two organizations or two people, whatever. And so you have to actually take into account both sides. You can't say I'm going to change one side and then everything else is the environment around it.
All right, so we have 10 minutes. Let's have a chat.
Does anybody else have any questions before we just, like, talk about this?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to phrase it. I think I understand everything. I guess what I want to know more about, which I think you had to skip through a lot of, was sort of more like the practical application of these. Not practical, just the application of these.
Right.
Things. I can imagine that, like, you would be hired to understand a system and then with this knowledge choose one way of understanding how you're going to move forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, knowing that these other foundations exist,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And then coming up with some kind of report for some kind of government like Kathmandu, like the city of Kathmandu or something, right? That's kind of what this is for.
Mm-hmm.
And as a systemic designer, you have to have an understanding of where you're going to intervene in the system and where your boundaries are, because you've been likely brought in by someone, or you're from an outside perspective and you're doing research on the system. You have to be able to say, you know, maybe I can, I don't know, do something that's a smaller intervention that might create a certain level of change or support some kind of whatever shift.
Yeah.
Where some other things, like, if you're trying to get rid of the mafia, that's a much different kind of problem, right? So where are there things that are shiftable and not shiftable? And are you going to just be banging your head against the wall trying to make a change?
If no one else has...
I have a question. Would it be possible to go to the regime ship slide? I just wanted to see those diagrams.
Okay, sure. Okay, so again, we have the blankets. You have the blankets and the balls, right? So the question would be, if you were going to make a change, will the change actually stick? So first, can you make a change? If it's a really, really deep trough, you're going to have a problem making a change. That's a resilient system. Then, if you can make a change, do you have an equally deep pocket that you're going to go into, or is this going to be something temporary and then you fly back?
And from a design perspective, often this comes along the four levels that Peter talks about, you know, a slide with the strange making thing before. So often people will think of very difficult changes and be like, oh, so you can just make a sign and then that's going to change. Like they think that your level of intervention might be at like a first order design, which is like essentially like graphic or communication design. But often the changes that they're looking for are actually at a much more transformative level that take a significant amount of time and investment and collaboration and all the things that like they are not aware of.
So on this note of equilibrium, like perhaps arguably the most famous example of equilibrium in a discipline is economics, where it's wrong. Like there's a punctuated dynamic equilibrium, but it's strictly people see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess how would you approach trying to convince people that you know this should change in this direction?
Yeah. So using the word equilibrium is a bit dangerous, and so you really want to get to the word's term steady state. And example that I use is if you look at the mobile phone market, it's been quite a while, but when Nokia was at the top, you had the idea that you would that they would have high-priced phones in a small market because that's what works in the West, which is monopoly work. So you reduce supply, and the price goes up, right? Because it's a rare item. The Chinese that were building mobile phones said, no, we're going to do the other way. We're going to go way down the demand curve. We're going to go all the way to the bottom, and we're going to have lots of cheap phones. And so it's like, okay, you could take both strategies. You can have cheap phones and now go mass market, or you can have expensive phones that go for a very specific high-end market, and those are both stable states. Now the question would Nokia survive? Is it possible for someone to survive at a luxury good? And there are instances where people do that, right? The companies do that. They say, we're gonna do that. My career at IBM, one of the things that I know from IBM is like, what IBM does is they should be having fewer customers because they have very expensive people and you can't afford to have a large company with lots of expensive people in it. You have to have fewer customers, you serve fewer people and you have a higher profit. So there are multiple stable states that will persist. You just have to decide that's what you're going to target, and then the question is that viable? Is that going to be a deep pocket where you could actually stay there for a while where supply equals demand, there's enough demand that you won't get shocked when there's a little blip in the market.
And are you designing for that level too? Is part of the other like huge piece. Because if you go in and you think that you're at a massive like the high end level and you're really not, that's a real
BlackBerry.
Yeah,
a high end product disrupted by the iPhone, which split the difference between those markets.
I would say that also strategy. Like that's where your design camp strategy bones will like be helpful in figuring out those answers.
Somebody's got to decide. Somebody's choice.
Ali?
So the social ecological systems borrow from, say, if they're ecology based, right? And then the socio ecological are organization based. So, what's the primary difference?
Between A and B?
Yeah. I think I get B.
Okay.
A comes from the foundation that they were studying organizations, human systems. So all this work is actually published in the journal called Human Relations. And so you should be not surprised. And so the question is, you know, how much are you paying, how much attention are you paying towards the human system, the social system, and how much attention are you paying towards the ecological system? And, you know, business people will say, you know, we'll let the ecology take care of itself, we're just focused on business opportunity and the social. It's kind of like, well, that's kind of a big debate right now, right?
I would also say in the work of doing design, often you might be brought in at an organization level, but the consideration of the ecological level is really critical too. So an example, I had a job where I was designing interaction design essentially for a chatbot for children, where it was like, figure out how are you actually going to mitigate or balance a one-to-one conversation between a child and a chatbot. But outside of that, we were like, yeah, but also we need to consider, like, where are you, it was for UNICEF, so where are you operating? How are we going to make this not be uncomfortable for kids to be, you know, think that they're talking to a human and it's not a human? Like, there was a whole bunch of ecological considerations in the actual one-to-one design, too. So it can be quite nested.
Well, there's almost an infinite number of descriptions of ecology, too. It depends on how it's framed and what the perspective is. There's not a definite enumerated number of certain ecologies. It's environmental to an organization. The ecology can be anything from the bioregion and the natural ecology. It can be the social networks that their employees participate in that are part of the business. Can be a global network that could be the ecology, the media ecology that it is communicating in and participating in. There's no single ecology. The sociological perspective can take into account everything from, you know, the natural ecological system in the bioregion to maybe the closest one would be the organizational boundary as an ecology, as an organizational ecology for the participants and the departments of the organization. So the ecological perspective, sociological works like David is, I don't know if it's kind of clicking in yet, but like any of the types of strategies you might be looking at, in strategy you're always looking at making some change in an environment, in an industry, in a market, in a supplier network, in a value constellation, and all of those can be described by sociological systems. And that, so it's not like, you know, using a technical systems thinking approach. It starts to become a natural way of thinking about where's the boundary of the environment where the system you're designing for is having that impact that that you're designing for.
Yeah. Okay. So just to follow on that, so I can understand it better. So is it, are you saying that people used to think in socio-ecological and then they transcended to a social ecological point of view, or is it that in terms of boundary drawing and the complexity of the problem that you're working with, you need to be mindful of whether you should select an organizational approach or a more ecological approach?
Well, no, this is taking the historical approach about the progression of ideas, right? You're going all the way from post-war into the 2000s and what's actually current now. So the critical question comes back to, what is the system that you are focused on, right? That's really what it is. It could be that you're there to tackle an ecology and that you can't actually influence the parts. But it could also be that you're just doing one part and yes, there's things coming at you from the external environment and you take account of them because you're too inwardly focused. So definition of what the system is important.
So just to clarify, are we talking about the ecosystem? Is it just context?
Context, often the word context is used because it's things outside of the system, yes.
We have 1 more minute for discussion.
So I was curious how this did connect with your strategy course, whether these ideas are starting to align.
I have been making this illustration that I would love to discuss with you in the break, but I didn't want to start ranting about this stuff to the class and not.
It could take all day.
Yeah, no, I,
And we only have 46 seconds.
Yeah. So I have
okay, right, and yes.
Fantastic.
37, okay.
Yeah, I do say, like, at least with our group, we're tackling Boeing in our strategy class. And so, like, having this understanding is very, very helpful.
Yeah.
Because we're now, we're like, are we talking about just Boeing? Is it something with the airlines? Is it something with the regulation? Is it something with the customers?
Yeah.
Like, what's actually causing the problems at Boeing? And there's, like, it's not just, like, bad management at Boeing. Like, there's, like, a ton of different factors. So that, like, all this stuff has been, like, really, really helpful in, like, trying to get at the problem and, like, how we want to treat it.
And then when you start to look at, like, almost like a service design perspective of like how do you actually like build a thing to enact the change, you have to look at all of those levers again to be like, okay, well, how does this actually, it's almost like an orchestration, how does this thing actually come about? And it's like music on a stem, like there's all of these different operations that have to move, choreographed to happen at the same time at a systemic level that you may not have control over, and well, you won't because it's a system, and so it's going to do its.
Boeing's interesting because that's also a temporal ecology because it's, you have to take into account the very long lead time of airplane orders and the well-known budgets for them well in advance of orders, and then the order flow. All that's really well known because, you know, they don't, if there's a fly-off between if a country is buying like a flag airline and they're going to choose between, I mean, they really have just a small number of vendors. So there's Boeing and Airbus for the big birds. And then there's Bombardier and Embraer. There's a small number for the regional jets.
Which is,
and so it's really fixed when you know your only competitor and you know each other's strategies. It, you know, sometimes it comes down to, fortunately, with the 737 MAX, what they did to save costs. And they blew it. You know, so. And so that's, it seems like a simple ecosystem. You got one competitor, and the industry is, you know, all the parts providers, all the trade secrets, and then a well-known number of customers. So they've got to know each other's strategies pretty well.
We're actually ahead.
We're ahead one. Just because you mentioned the connection to strategy, and also obviously there's a connection to foresight, but I was just thinking about almost like counterfactuals or almost like ridiculous interventions. Mm-hmm. Like just what Peter was saying about this duopoly that exists between Boeing and Airbus. Like, what if you imagined that the UN somehow mandated that there had to be a third player or something like that? Like, just as saying, if that was ever the case, which it never would be, how would that intervention, you know, affect the system, and how could you think about that?
There is, though. Like, there's Ilyushin. Russia's going to get into the business.
And China is.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I knew, yeah. I mean, Russia's very mature with their airliners. Probably.
But, like, can you imagine,
China's fast.
Yeah, like, if China's, like, nowhere near the competition right now, but what happens if they, like, steal some key, like, trade secrets, or, like, develop their own, like, super innovative airliner, and then they're like in the market right away, and then like how do these two like competitors adapt? And like it's interesting because like you're talking about like delayed loops, and like making an airliner takes like 5 to 7 years, so like you like order all these airliners and then like you build all of them, and then 7 years later the whole landscape has changed, and like how do you adapt to
that? It's like Huawei and the gift that Trump has given Huawei. It's a real gift, because why would you deal with building another phone operating system, another mobile operating system, when there's one that's available? Oh, it's not available anymore. Now it's like, okay, well, we can build one.
Now there's going to be a world operating system that I'm looking forward to. I've got a Huawei. For that reason, I want to get off Android and try something else.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks, David. If you're lucky.
So you don't have to draw panarchies for P1 dossier. It would be an extra, so right? It's not in the baseline. But. Feel free, but you know, save it for the synthesis map.
So Peter, you have 15 minutes for systemograms.
Oh, am I next?
Yeah, you weren't here for my warning, but I'm being
okay.